Okay, I'd like to welcome Jeffrey Peterson. Jeffrey is the director of the University of Minnesota Water Resources Center. As director, he provides overall leadership for the center's outreach, teaching, and research activities. Jeffrey also holds a faculty appointment as professor in the Department of Applied Economics. Prior to coming to Minnesota, he held a faculty position at the Department of Agricultural Economics, Kansas State University, for 15 years, where he also served as Director of Graduate Studies from 2014 to 2015. Jeffrey is also the recipient of national awards for his research on environmental policy analysis, focusing on water use and water quality impacts from agriculture. And he also serves as an editor for the Journal of Agricultural and Resource Economics. And today, Jeffrey's presentation is entitled Economics of Irrigation and Groundwater Depletion. Welcome.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks for inviting me. Everybody hear me okay? What do I need to do here? Better? Okay, good. Well, I appreciate the invitation to be here. So our center focuses a lot on water quality issues, as some of you might know, but I have, before I came here and I was working at Kansas State and doing other things on water use issues mostly, so I'm going to focus this talk on groundwater depletion. I've given variants of this talk. These slides are actually based on talks I've given to student groups over the years, and there's usually no better way to get students' attention than starting with quiz questions, so I just kept these on here. The first question is, surface water bodies like we see all around us here in Minnesota, lakes, rivers, reservoirs, and wetlands, store about what percentage of global freshwater? What do you think that answer is? It's D, yeah, see, I knew this audience would have it. Less than 1%. And how about aquifers? What percentage would you guess, what percentage of global freshwater do aquifers store? It's actually 30%. And at this point, the students are starting to feel a little cheated when I tell them that I sort of asked a trick question, because I didn't remind them that fresh water had to be in its liquid form and couldn't be in the form of snow. Actually, most of it in the world turns out to be in the form of snow in mountainous regions. Antarctica has a huge amount of water stored there, places like Greenland. So it turns out to be 0.3% is in surface freshwater bodies, 30% in aquifers. Okay, I'm almost done. What sector is the largest user of fresh water on a global basis, and what percentage of water use does that sector account for? So, very good. Somebody went straight to the answer, F. Agriculture, 70%. And there is a subtle distinction here whether you're actually talking about consumptive water use or water withdrawals, which I'll get into in a minute. But if you measure it by water withdrawals, this is the FAO data that shows that on a global scale, about 70% of the freshwater diverted goes to use in agriculture. About 20% goes to industry and the rest to municipalities. Obviously, there's lots of variation depending on where you are in the world. The percentage going to ag varies from about 20% in Europe all the way up to over 80% in Africa. And so here's a picture at a country scale. In the US, we're right around 50% of withdrawals at a national scale go to agriculture. And this is a graph you could look at for a long time, and I'm not gonna get into all the intricacies of it. This is data that was put together by USGS, and the graph itself was put together by the Lawrence Livermore National Labs. What this graph shows is that, so the width of the bands on here indicate, let's see here, the widths of the bands indicate the amount of water as a flow, okay? And this graph shows the way that water originates from its different sources through different uses, and then over here shows up as how that water is ultimately distributed. Okay, whoop. I'll stay on the U.S. for the moment. And it, in case you can't see it in the back of the room, this, the categories of the sources are surface freshwater, surface water from saline sources, fresh groundwater, and saline groundwater, okay? And the distinction I want to make here is that if you measure it by water withdrawals, okay, the amount of water flowing into one of these sectors, the largest user is thermoelectric cooling in the United States, about half of water, a little more than half of water withdrawals. What's shown here in this gray band going out of thermoelectric cooling is the amount that's actually consumed or evaporated. That's a pretty small percentage. Most of the rest of it flows back, is discharged back into either freshwater bodies or into the ocean. So if you measure it in terms of actual use, it remains true that irrigation is the largest user in the United States in terms of consumptive use. This is what it looks like in Minnesota. When they created these graphs, they kept the boxes the same for every state, but obviously we don't have any saline sources of water. It remains true in Minnesota that actually by even a larger percentage, thermoelectric cooling accounts for most of our water withdrawals. And in total, it actually also accounts for the most consumptive use in Minnesota. But if you just focus on groundwater, which is the green bands here, the biggest users of groundwater, no surprise probably to everybody in this room, are the public supplies and domestic uses, followed by irrigation. And then of groundwater diverted to these various uses, irrigation is the biggest consumptive user. Okay. So now I want to zoom back out to a global scale and just talk about water withdrawals a little bit and think about the trend, what's been happening to all this over time. And what you can see in this graph is that global water withdrawals have been going up pretty steadily, and they continue to go up across all those different sectors. Turns out that tracks pretty closely, correlates really strongly with population growth. In the recent decades, population is growing faster than water use, which means we're getting somewhat more efficient at using water on a global scale. But as population continues to go up, you know, it's hard to believe that freshwater use is going to be going down anytime soon. So the history of this is kind of interesting and gets back to the distinction between surface and groundwater. So as economists, you know, we like to categorize things based on supply and demand. You can think of this part as the demand part of the story. It shows the use of water going up. And the question is, what have we done to satisfy that demand? What have we done on the supply side? It turns out there are two kind of phases of how we've done that in history. Up until about the middle of the 20th century, mostly the way we did that was by tapping into surface water supplies. But since then, more and more we've been tapping into groundwater. So there's many of these surface water projects around the world, and you can see, I think this one's from the western United States somewhere, where we found various ways to harness surface water supplies, and basically transfer water across seasons from winter snowmelt into summer use. For various reasons, the most obvious of which is that eventually we sort of ran out of the most advantageous places to build dams. They became more expensive to build. There's major environmental impacts. So as demand continued to go up more and more, what we did is we tapped into aquifers. And there's that story has played out kind of right here in the Twin Cities, if you think about it. So Minneapolis and St. Paul, for their municipal use, take their water out of the Mississippi River. As we had population growth in the Twin Cities, a lot of that was in the surrounding suburbs. Most of those municipalities take their water from aquifers. So here's what the trends look like, broken down by country and region. It's going up almost everywhere. The United States is the purple line there. The one that really jumps out at you is India. I'll come back to that as an example. It's an interesting case study. What this graph shows is three things. The top line here is global water demand. This graph goes from 1960 to 2000. It's a 40-year period. You can see that water demand is roughly doubled over that period. The middle line is groundwater withdrawals, or what's called abstraction in this study. As we've talked about, it's pretty closely tracking the increase in groundwater or in overall water demand. Nowadays, as water demand goes up, mostly what we do is pump more groundwater. The bottom line is showing groundwater depletion. So if we keep pumping more and more water at a global scale out of the planet's aquifers, we're pumping more out than what the total rate of natural recharge is. What has to happen is you begin to deplete the store of global groundwater. And this shows year-by-year depletion. So this is the amount that was depleted. That process had already begun in 1960. This is the amount of depletion in 1960, amount of depletion in 1961, and so on. If depletion year-by-year is going up, what that means is not only are we depleting the world's aquifers, but we're doing so at an accelerating rate, right? And this is what cumulative depletion looks like at a global scale. The gray bands on here just represent uncertainty in the data. And you can see the different countries and regions of the world. The U.S. is in red there. So this is what cumulative depletion looks like on a map. And you can see what the hotter colors on the rainbow represent more more depletion here. If you look carefully, you can see in the U.S. they're small, but there's red spots here in California. This is the High Plains Aquifer in Kansas, Nebraska, and Texas, that area. There's other places of depletion, the North China Plain and places in the Middle East. Again, what really jumps out at you is India, and it's specifically this northern region in India along the border with Pakistan. Okay, so I've explained we've got, hopefully the data are fairly clear. There's depletion going on, aquifer depletion going on at a global scale. A logical question is, what are the impacts of all this, right? Why might it matter? So what do you think are some of these, from the list here, are potential impacts? Sea level rise, satellite orbits, fruit fly populations, or some combination of those? All of the above? Yeah, I mean, maybe I threw fruit flies in there just to throw people off, but maybe we'll find a paper someday that shows there's a link. But there's a documented link at least between sea level rise, groundwater depletion, and sea level rise and orbits of satellites. So I'll talk about a couple of those. So if you think about what's going on here, there's only so many different places the Earth has that it can store water. Aquifers is one. We talked about snowpack. Oceans is a big one. If you deplete the water that was in aquifers, it has to end up somewhere. And the way we've got the hydrologic cycle operating, the agriculture being the biggest user of water, you apply water for crops, that water, most of it at least transpires back into the atmosphere. It falls as rain somewhere else. Some of that might percolate back into the aquifers, get transpired and go back to the atmosphere again. But in the end, it's extra precipitation that falls and runs off and ends up in rivers and streams, which ultimately drain into the ocean. So aquifer depletion means more water in the ocean. This graph shows the year-by-year amount of sea level rise. And if you were to add everything up over this period of a century, in the 20th century, it would be 3 centimeters of sea level rise due to groundwater depletion, which doesn't sound like much, but it's significant. It's about 15 to 20% of the observed sea level rise during that period. Of course, there are other things driving sea level rise as well, climate change being the primary one, but aquifer depletion is another one that people don't talk about very much. Oh, and I should mention that these colored lines here are projections about the amount of sea level rise in the future based on different climate scenarios. Okay, the fun one, gravity. So, it turns out that the force of gravity around Earth is not constant. And among other things, it depends in any one location, the force of gravity depends on the density of the Earth's crust at that location. The density of the Earth's crust, in turn, depends, at least in part, on how much water is stored in all the layers on the surface and all the subsurface layers as well. So if you start depleting water, it will change the density of the Earth's crust, and it will affect the gravitational signal. So NASA had a project to take advantage of this and launch these, what are called the GRACE satellite battery. It's a battery of 2 satellites that are capable of detecting these slight variations in gravity. Those satellites have been orbiting now for a number of years, so we have we have time series data on that you can use to estimate the change in water stored in all these surface and subsurface layers. So let me see if I can get, and this video, if I can get it to play, is showing that area in northern India based on GRACE satellite data. You can see it basically being dried out, if you will. This is really advantageous for parts of the world where we don't have good well monitoring data, and you can see what's going on. We've also got some interesting estimates of depletion in the US, and this is what the GRACE estimates look like here. Of course, we all know Minnesota is a water-rich state, but in terms of the trend here, we are going through a trend of dewatering. And there's a number of factors playing into that, climate change being one, the use of groundwater right here in the suburbs of the Twin Cities being another. John Niebuhr, who's a faculty member at the University of Minnesota in biosystems and bioproducts engineering, he's a hydrologist, he has a project going on right now looking at GRACE data and refining some of these estimates of change in water storage in Minnesota. So those will results will be coming out. So from here on, what I'd like to do just a little bit is talk about the economic forces that are driving all of this, and also the economic consequences of groundwater depletion. There's 2 dimensions I'll talk about. One is externalities. So if you've run across that term before, an externality, when economists bat the term around, just means a cost, usually means a cost, that one entity can impose on another entity without compensating them. Sometimes these are thought of as like spillover costs. So we'll talk about those. The externalities turn out to be really crucial for understanding the economics of groundwater depletion. And then there are also some fairness or equity issues. It turns out that groundwater depletion has an impact on the distribution of income and wealth. Within externalities, there's 2 types I want to talk about. One is what I'm referring to here as transported externalities. So these are the costs that one group of users of groundwater would impose on other people at some other location because of the depletion they're creating. So we've already talked about sea level rise. I think probably the producers in Kansas and Nebraska might be a little bit surprised or just didn't know that the fact that they're using water for irrigation for their crops there and gradually depleting the aquifer is imposing a cost in the form of increased risk of flooding in place in low-lying island countries, right? So that's one form. Another form that gets talked about a lot in Minnesota and is important here is the effects on stream flow. So when aquifers are connected to surface water bodies like streams, it reduces the level of stream flow, which can have impacts on aquatic habitats and recreation and even navigation. If those aquifer waters are containing nutrients or other contaminants, this kind of thing also has an effect on contaminant transport. So, interestingly, there are also these regional climate effects. So there were a group of climatologists at the University of Kansas who did some interesting work that found that the irrigation in the Great Plains puts more water vapor into the atmosphere in that part of the world than otherwise would be there. And that affects regional weather patterns. And it turns out that the way the regional wind patterns work, a lot of that extra water vapor turns out to come down in the form of increased levels of precipitation in places like southern Minnesota. So irrigation in Kansas affects rainfall in Minnesota. That could be a cost if it's coming at a time of year when we don't need the water, right? Or if it's coming as a more intensive event. It potentially could be a benefit if it's coming at a time when we need water, right? So, and then there's what I'll call the local externalities or the common pool externalities, which are the force that's really, or one of the forces that's driving depletion in the first place. So here's what's going on. If an aquifer is this common pool resource, so if all of us are pumping from the same aquifer and using it for our benefits to irrigate our crops or whatever, as an individual, I have a very limited incentive, economic incentive, to conserve that resource. If I decide I want to conserve it and reduce my pumping, I'll take a hit in terms of my crop yields and whatever, lower income now. Most of the benefits, and almost entirely all the benefits of doing that, will go to you guys, right? Because you're pumping out of the, I'll get a little bit of benefit, but I'm saving water mostly that a lot of other people could tap into. So this kind of misalignment incentives is what's sometimes called, rather dramatically, the tragedy of the commons. And in India, it turns out they have a sort of runaway common pool effect or a runaway tragedy of the commons. So if we have time, which I think maybe we do, I'll just briefly talk about that. So there's these things called tube wells in India, which we would think of as a mechanically drilled and mechanically pumped well. But those are in contrast to the traditional hand-dug wells. It would have looked like that. They're, of course, very labor-intensive to install in the first place, also very labor-intensive to extract water from. And this very elegant artwork here shows an aquifer, which has the saturated zone here. These are meant to be hand-dug wells, and this is the water table level. This is the land surface up here. What happened was this technology for mechanically drilled and pumped tube wells came along, and it was attractive to a lot of farmers. The government of India actually saw this as an opportunity for poverty alleviation, because it can really be helpful for farmers if they have this mechanical well. They can pump water much more easily and produce crops more efficiently to get them out of some of these poverty traps. So they were subsidized. Tube well installation was subsidized. It turns out that, not unlike the Western United States, or some country, some many states in the U.S., there's a very old law going back to the 1880s, I think, in India that gives individuals the right to access water on their land if they can tap into it. So they have the right to access water. The government subsidized the not only the drilling of tube wells, but also the electricity to operate the wells, and they could be drilled anywhere. And what happened was, of course, that these things began to deplete the aquifer. So you see these things go down. And what do you think the response to that depletion would be? If you're an individual farmer and you see your water level going down, you have these subsidies out there to drill more, you would just drill more wells or drill your existing ones deeper. And that's exactly what happened. And that, of course, led to even further depletion. And sadly, it also led to shortages for what you could think of as the poorest of the poor, the people who are still operating with hand-dug wells, literally left high and dry by this. So there's lots of discussion about how to respond to this. But you can see why this, at a lot of levels, it's a natural idea. It makes sense as poverty alleviation, and it did achieve that objective for many people. You can also see how it's individually rational for people to respond to that program, and the aggregate result is that we get this depletion. I got this just a little bit out of order. So that's the externalities. The last thing I'll mention is the effect on fairness or the distribution of wealth. This case study from India illustrates that groundwater depletion can have an effect on what's sometimes called intra-generational equity, the distribution of wealth within a current generation of people. If you're talking about long-term depletion over a period of decades or centuries, you also have to consider intergenerational equity, the balance of wealth between this current generation and future generations. If we pump water out of aquifers and deplete that natural asset, we're leaving a diminished asset for future generations. To illustrate that, this is a study that was done in Kansas by, I didn't work on this particular study, but I worked with these folks a lot. They projected that groundwater pumping in Kansas would peak around the year 2020, and it would start going down over that. This concept is sometimes called peak water. Water pumping would peak around 2020 and then start going down just because of the fact that there's a smaller store there, it's more expensive to get out, and you physically can't pump it at a fast enough rate in a 75-day or so growing season. Peak water, if you keep growing grain, will inevitably be followed by peak grain. If you're applying less water, eventually you're going to be producing less output. You can delay the peak somewhat, and you can see here there's a difference in when these two peaks occurs. And the reason for that is that they're assuming in this study that the rates of technological progress we've been seeing with things like improvements in crop varieties and improved irrigation technology, those things will keep going, right? And if they keep going, the assumption in this study is that they would keep going at historical rates. And the technological progress can overcome our lack of water supplies for some period, but not forever. That was the point of that, or one of the points from that study. So there is going to be, technology can help us out, but eventually there's just going to be an effect between the current generation and future generations. So when economists look at this problem, you know, we've been working on I would say about four different major topics. One of them is to quantify these different costs of depletion. Another is looking at the effectiveness of maybe different policies that you could use to conserve water, trying to address this common pool effect. Then assess the impacts on the distribution of wealth and look at these long-range projections. So with that, I am happy to take questions if we have time.
I thank you for talking about the economic side of things. It's always nice to hear that. I want to call attention back to a statement you made in regards to the consumer's pool extremities.
Externalities.
sorry for mispronouncing it, but yep. And you made a statement that it's not economic or for farmers to conserve water because it's an economic benefit to them. What about the cost of irrigation? I would turn that and say they do have a benefit in conserving water because there's a cost to irrigation. So there's a balance between an economic value of what they're going to get for the cost of pumping and actually irrigation.
So. Yeah, thanks for that. So there's no question that at an individual level, there is some benefit from conserving, because if you conserve water, you reduce the depletion underneath your farm, the rate of depletion underneath your farm. And that means that in the future, you'll have a lower cost of extraction than you would have otherwise, right? The thing is, though, that not only if you're conserving water, so there's a benefit to you, but most of the benefit, depending on hydrologic conditions, and that's an important distinction to make here, if you're really pumping from a common pool, if you conserve water, it reduces the rate of depletion for not only you, but for all your neighbors as well. So you're transferring that benefit of reduced pumping cost to your neighbors as well as yourself. So you bear all of the costs for conservation, you spread the benefits among you and everybody else. So that's the disparity.
Have you looked at any studies, or do you know of any information that would place a value on groundwater as a commodity?
Yeah, so there's a lot of estimates out there. They are very location specific, as you might expect. And it also depends on whether you're talking about pumped groundwater that you use and sell that water as a marketed commodity, or you're talking about the stored amount of water as an asset, right? And there's a distinction there. There's studies on both topics. The value of both of the pumped water and the water as an asset tends to be very high in areas of the world where water is scarce, right? And that's the paradox, right?
Talking about the tragedy of the commons, and that's a phrase we've probably all heard. I learned a lot about that the past couple years. I read a really interesting book on the topic, and one of the things I learned about the commons is there really are three things that are needed to have a commons and a common asset. One is something that's an asset that's being shared, like water or land. Two is a set of rules that have been created by the people who are utilizing that commons for a purpose. That's the second thing. And the third thing is punishments that occur to those people who violate the rules for the use of the commons. So when you're missing one of the three legs of that stool, then there can be a tragedy. But really, in some situations recently, what we're seeing is not really the use of a commons as it was practiced in England for 1,000 years, successfully, until the Enclosure Acts. Mm-hmm. So that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it also highlights the fact that the tragedy of the commons is not destiny, right? You can develop rules, and there's a number of legal innovations and things, rule systems that have been implemented around the world to address it.
Quick question. Do you feel that our policies are actually going to change in the next 30 years to start addressing this depletion, or are we just doomed to see it depleted completely?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Well, of course, as we saw in the data, there's an enormous amount of spatial variation, so it depends on where you are. And it's also true that there are places that have done a lot to address these issues, and we do see rates of depletion reduce rates of depletion in some places. The countervailing forces, unfortunately, are that climate change is not working in our favor. It's getting hotter and drier in precisely the places that are water stressed. And population growth and distribution are also not working in our favor. There's population growth in these water stressed areas. So there's a lot of work to be done.
All right, I think we'll wrap it up. Or
do we have time for one more?
Yeah, we can squeeze one more.
Thanks. The tragedy of the commons, can't that, in a sense, be all boiled down to a cost allocation issue? I mean, you're just not charging the right prices in the right places for things. And could that not, in principle, be fixed by charging the appropriate fees?
Yeah, you're hitting that right on. And that's, in fact, the way the economists often study the problem is that it's a misallocation of pricing, and one of the ways to address it is to change the pricing. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.